This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the Stage of History.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. My name is Tom and I am joined, as ever, by Mr. Michael Phelan. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Tom.
Was it weird that I called you Michael?
A little bit, Tom. A little bit.
Feel free to call me Thomas if you like. We are joined by a very special guest today. He is a gaming royalty, retro gaming royalty. His name is Darren Jones. Welcome, Darren.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a complete pleasure. For those people listening who don't know who Darren is, that's probably minus 1% of you. Darren is the editor of Retro Gamer magazine. Darren, quick question before we continue. I've always wondered this. What's the difference between an editor and an editor-in-chief? Is there one?
Yeah, effectively, an editor oversees the running of a magazine.
Mm.
The editor-in-chief oversees the runnings of magazines. No. So think of them kind of like project managers, where you have a project manager who he's basically overseeing all the other managers who are doing other things.
Right.
So for example, at Future, we have like Tony Mott, and he's the editor-in-chief who oversees all the video games magazines.
Ah, Tony Mott. He's the guy who wrote 1001 Games You Should Play Before You Die, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that he was involved with it. I don't think he wrote all of it, but I think it was like a combination of various Edge freelancers and stuff who put it together.
Cool.
But I've got that book. It's good.
Yeah, so have I. Yeah, somewhere. It's on one of my shelves somewhere. Anyway, we're jumping the gun slightly. Welcome to episode 54 of the world's greatest Dreamcast podcast called Dream Pod. That's because it's the only one called Dream Pod. But we'll start as we always do. We'll talk a little bit about things we have played and things we've picked up. Not necessarily Dreamcast, but also current gen or retro. Darren, you are our guest, so I'm going to come to you first. I'm sure there's quite a few things you've played in the recent past, so please enlighten us and our listeners.
Okay then, well, I haven't bought any Dreamcast games forever. Mainly because my focus is on the Nintendo DS at the moment.
Oh yeah.
So I've been picking up way, way too many games and not actually playing them, because what's the point in doing that? So literally, I think the last few games, because what I tend to do is I buy all my games from America, because the British box art is absolutely awful, and the American stuff just looks so much more vibrant. Mm. So I tend to buy stuff in bulk. So I'll buy like 10 games at a time when I can afford it. And the last few games I picked up included things like 9 Hours, 9 Seasons, 9 Doors, Front Mission, things like basically a lot of RPGs. So, and I'm not really sure why I've picked them up, because I don't really play many RPGs, but I kind of bought them on the fact that, well, they'll, you know, you'll get a lot of mileage out of them if I ever get around to playing them. So I picked up about 10 RPGs, which I probably will never play.
Well, brilliant, fantastic. You're in good company here, because myself and Mike do that quite regularly, and not just with RPGs, but with Dreamcast games, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Have you been playing anything on current gen systems?
Yeah, I got into the Switch recently.
Mm.
So I've kind of got a love hate relationship with the Switch, but I've been playing Skyrim, mainly because I'm reviewing it for the mag. I've been playing FIFA 18, which I've been really enjoying.
Yeah.
I just bought a copy of Bomberman, because I got it for £20, which seemed a good price.
Yeah, it's good, that, actually.
And I also picked up Rabbids and, what was the other one? Binding of Isaac. So, yeah, I've been buying loads of Switch games as well, and I've played hardly any of them.
Now, Darren, you said there that you have a love-hate relationship with the Switch. What's the hate all about?
My biggest problem with the Nintendo Switch are the people who love the Nintendo Switch. I think Nintendo fanboys are the best and worst things about Nintendo. And but also it's just I love the way that it's obviously a hybrid machine. I love the fact that it fits into whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. But the downside to that is I think it's a really poorly made handheld. And I just don't like how it feels when I'm using it as a handheld.
Yeah.
So I've got fairly big hands and I'm quite clumsy and stuff. And it just feels like every time I pick it up, it just feels like I'm going to break it. It just feels very flimsy. And you know, I love Nintendo handhelds, and this is the first one which it's really taken me a long time to warm to.
It's interesting you say that because I also have a Switch and I'm quite fond of it. But like yourself, I'm quite fond of the Vita as well. And going between the two, as I am quite want to do, I find that the because I'm now so used to the Switch, I find the Vita like really small. Is that something that you've come across?
Yeah, but I like that because again, you know, handhelds haven't traditionally always been tiny. I mean, the Game Boy was fairly large, the Lynx was gigantic. But I don't know. I think when you look at what Nintendo's done beforehand, it feels a little. I don't know, it's kind of like, it's obviously a jack of all trades, and they've obviously had to make compromises, and I understand that, but I just don't like the compromises they've made. And it's just little things, like how on the left-hand Joy-Con, the D-pads are like right in line with each other, so if you're trying to select the bottom one with your thumb, it just doesn't feel natural to move downwards, whereas it would feel better if you could slightly move it to the left like you would on a joypad. It's only little things. I mean, you know, I love playing the games on it, but I just don't think the hardware is as good as it could be, and I'd imagine that in a year and a half we'll get a far better upgrade, as Nintendo want to do.
I've been kind of thinking the same, but like I say, I do love the Switch, and I won't have a bad word said about it, so keep that in mind. Thanks, Darren. Thank you for that. Mike, what have you been playing? Retro or otherwise?
So I've it's like a Switch podcast at the moment. I've also been playing on the Switch. I've been playing Skyrim mainly. Picked up Skyrim and L.A. Noire, and I'm getting a lot of use out of both. Skyrim's my favourite game of all time, so it's great to play it on the move. I've also picked up Skyrim on the VR because I'm a little bit obsessive like that.
I've got that as well.
It looks good, but it's given me major motion sickness. So I'm going back to it again and then seeing how far I can get. But it's a problem I've got with the VR. I've put loads of hours into the VR and I've played, you know, played through Drive Club VR and I've played through played Bridge Crew loads of hours, but I just can't get the whole moving around as well as being on the VR. It makes me sick, which is a real shame.
Yeah, I mean, I've never played Skyrim, so how did the two compare? Is it basically exactly the same game on the Switch as it is on the other consoles? Or
yeah. Pretty much. It's a Game of the Year edition.
Yeah, so apart from like minor graphical sort of downgrades, it's basically the same game.
I haven't played it in docked mode, so I don't know what it's like on TV, but in handheld mode.
It looks pretty good on the TV.
Yeah?
Yeah. I would imagine it would. It looks good on handheld. It looks good. You can obviously tell it's not quite running full res, but it's good. The thing with Skyrim is that the graphics aren't really the point as such.
Yeah.
It's the experience of enveloping yourself in the world, which the Switch does well.
It feels like a more competent port than Doom, and Doom was a decent port, but it doesn't, because of the nature of the game, it doesn't really have the frame rate issues that Doom has. So yeah, it's good.
No, I've seen no issues at all, which is good. I've L.A. Noire as well, I've been playing on Switch, and that's a really good, really good port. I didn't play a huge amount of it at the time when it came out. I have got it on 360, but I never really played that much of it, and it looks amazing in handheld. It's probably the best looking handheld game I've played.
Really?
It's not technically a handheld game, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no.
I'll have to take your word for that, because it's a game I've got no interest in going back to.
So, did you play it on the 360 and the PS3 then, Darren? Or?
Yeah, I thought it was absolutely terrible.
Fair enough.
Cool. It's quite slow. It is quite a slow game.
It's that whole thing of like everybody was going on about, oh my god, look how amazing the texture of the faces are.
Yeah.
But it loses all credibility as soon as you see them walking around, because they look like fucking mannequins on Ritalin. It's just fucking ridiculous.
I wasn't
impressed with it. I think that basically people love it because of the Rockstar factor, and I think it's a very average game.
Well, there you go, Mike.
That is probably true, to be fair. I think it's not a game which I would say is one of the all-time best, and it wouldn't have got anywhere near as much attention if it wasn't Rockstar.
I'm glad it's on the Switch, because it shows that companies like Rockstar are at least willing to try stuff on the machine. So, you know, I won't take away from anybody who's bought it and who's enjoying it. But for me, I didn't really like it. But it's good to see that companies like Rockstar are at least willing to like try stuff. Although I'd argue most people would have probably preferred like GTA 4 or something instead.
I was going to say, actually, do you think that opens the door for a GTA port on the Switch, Darren?
I think the problem with the Switch at the moment is obviously it's doing really well, but it's whether the game's sell in the way that the publishers will be happy with. So it could be that Rockstar are doing L.A. Noire as a test to see how well it does.
Yeah,
and the success of that will decide whether they do like GTA 5. Mm. And if they're doing that, I don't think L.A. Noire is the game to do that with.
Yeah, that's a good point, because obviously over the last couple of weeks we've seen that EA have been doing kind of the same thing with FIFA 18.
Yeah, but look at FIFA 18. It's had according to the figures that have been released.
Yeah.
It's done amazingly poorly on Switch.
Yes.
I mean, to give you an idea, if you I've been playing it a lot. I love it. I think it's brilliant. But you go on the transfer market and it's 30. I think there's 34,000 active transfers. You go on the PS4 and it's apparently around 5 million. You know, there's a huge gulf in the amount of people playing.
Yeah.
And I think what will happen is that EA will look at it. They'll see that it's basically made subtle money for them, and they just won't bother doing another one. Or if they do another one, it will just be just a legacy version.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's,
and then they'll stop it completely.
It's a shame, really.
So it's tricky. It's I don't know. I think as much as I like the Switch, I think it comes down to AAA games, and I just don't think that they are going to have enough support. I mean, Nintendo's games are great, but as you saw on the Wii U, that wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, anything on the Dreamcast?
Of course, Tom.
Of course.
I've picked up a few more games from Japan, of which I can't actually remember what they are now, which is really bad. I've got a few more visual novels, no doubt, to add to the shelf. And I've also picked up my copy of Dreamcastnoid.
Oh, cool. The tiny one with the little... Small.
Yeah, the one made in Spain was then shipped to America to then ship to people who live in the EU and therefore have to charge £13 of custom fees.
Darren,
I'm bitter.
Darren, I don't know if you've seen this, but basically this guy, he made a homebrew game which is basically Arkanoid, but you control a VMU at the bottom of the screen and you have to fire ball
cool.
around. But the blocks at the top are actually PlayStation 2s. So and he's actually released it in physical form, but the discs are like tiny GameCube style discs, and it's a tiny little box, and it's really cute. You know, it looks really nice. You know, a little tiny Dreamcast game in a physical box. It's commendable, really. So
yeah.
Anything else, Mike?
That sounds pretty good. I'll have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. Anything else, Mike?
So in terms of playing games, I've been again going through the list of games. I've been playing Outrigger quite a lot in the last couple of weeks.
Hmm.
which is all right. It's not as good as Quake and Unreal.
Yeah.
I think maybe I missed the sort of boat on it. I think if I played it at a time, I would have been more impressed with it. But it's an interesting sort of arcade Sega take on the first person shooter genre.
One of the few games that also uses the twin stick as well, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. Yes. Mm. So I didn't actually try my twin sticks out on it, which I really do. I should do really.
It's not that good, to be honest, because the twin sticks are actually digital, so it's not very good for aiming. So it's quite difficult. But if you can get them set up, it's worth just investigating to see if you like the controls, really.
Yeah. And I also picked up the last of the Aerodancing games. You've written an article quite recently, Tom.
Yes, indeed.
I picked up the last one, which was the Aerodancing F, or Aerowings 2, the disc for that.
Oh, the bonus disc.
The bonus disc, yeah. So nice. I bought that one.
Anything that's one I don't think I've got. So is there anything interesting on that disc, or is it just basically
I think it's the same? VMU data and replays and stuff, and I think there might be a few extra missions as well.
Yeah, because the one that I did get, which had something interesting on it, was the one for the first game, which has got the Inside the House, and it's almost like a more graphically impressive version of Toy Commander with the little Dreamcast and everything. Yeah, that's really cool. But I think that's the one I couldn't get, because I got Aerodancing I and the disc for Aerodancing I, and that was it. Couldn't find F. But, cool. Quite an interesting selection there. I'll kind of just whiz through things I've picked up and played. Dreamcast-wise, I've been playing quite a lot of Buggy Heat, because that's a game that is actually a lot more fun than I remember it being. I don't know why I started playing it again, but I just saw it on the shelf the other day. I thought, I'm going to have a go on this. And about 3 or 4 hours later, I was still playing it. And it's, quite a good game. Pickups-wise, I've only picked up Power Stone 2, the PAL version, which is a game I had back in the day when I had my original Dreamcast. Darren, I don't know if I've bored you with this story in the past, but when the Dreamcast originally came out, I had one. I had it for a couple of years. I had a ton of games, and I swapped them all and the console for a PlayStation 2. So I've not had this game since then, and got it again recently. Current gen, game you alluded to earlier, Darren, is Doom on the PlayStation 4 and on the Switch. Just because I wanted to kind of compare them. I did watch the Digital Foundry video comparing the two, or all the other versions, and it is a bit like looking at, it's like an N64 game, do you know what I mean? With like the blurriness of the screen.
It is impressive.
massively impressive, yeah.
I think the biggest problem with it is that you go into a shop, and you've got the option of paying £40 for the Switch version or a tenner for the PS4 and Xbox One versions. It's such a huge gulf in price. So, it's going to be interesting to see how it does.
Yeah. And I have looked at the Switch charts. Sorry, going back onto the Switch again. But it does seem to be doing quite well. So I think I read on Push Square, the website, last week, that it was at number 21 in the all formats charts. That's quite good.
That's not bad. That's pretty good.
Yeah, better than FIFA 18 anyway. Speaking of FIFA 18, that's another game I've been playing, just like you, Darren. I do really enjoy it. I'm actually playing through the career mode as Cheltenham FC, which is quite challenging, as you can imagine.
I can imagine, yeah.
But it's just really cool seeing these really low division teams on a Nintendo console, because it's just something I've not seen for so long. Also on the Switch, I've been playing Mario Odyssey.
That game is amazing.
It's just the best way to describe it is delightful. Because I could just get it and just start playing. I'm up to the Luncheon Kingdom. I've not finished it yet, but I'm just this game is just so lovely to look at. It's amazing.
I think when we reviewed it, I gave it a stand first or something the reason you play video games.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Didn't you give it 100%?
Certainly did, and I stand by that score.
To be honest, I can't disagree. I said on the last podcast we did, the only thing I don't like about it is the fact that when you start the game up, it goes, Super Mario Odyssey! And it's just I hate it.
That's literally the only reason I gave it 100%.
Fair enough. Whatever floats your boat. I've actually been playing on the Vita as well recently. I've been playing a game called Neon Chrome, which again is on the Switch, but it's a really cool, like, sort of twin stick shooter come like futuristic sci-fi. Like, do you remember Loaded on the PS1?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like that. And it's got amazing music as well. And it's just this really cool kind of like dystopian future. You're walking around almost like Judge Dredd. I know there was a game on the Switch called Judge, which uses the same engine. But Neon Chrome is definitely one worth picking up if you see it cheap. And last but not least, I've been playing Halo 4 again on the 360. And I was having a couple of discussions with people the other day about how good 360 games still look. And, you know, if developers can kind of aim for that quality on the Switch rather than trying to compete with current gen systems, I'd be more than happy, because Halo 4 looks absolutely amazing still. You know what I mean? It's just a really, really good looking game. Anyway, that's what we've been playing. That's what we've picked up. Let's move on to some news. Darren, I hope you don't feel kind of alienated with us talking about mainly kind of like really nerdy Dreamcast stuff. Feel free to jump in if you like. However, don't feel the need to.
Fine. You know, I was going for a complete PAL Dreamcast collection at one stage.
That is true, and we will come on to that shortly. Save it. Save it for the fans. right. News items. First thing I want to talk about, though, or rather give a mention to, is that Sega Nerds, their magazine, their digital magazine, Megavisions, is out now, issue number 5. The only reason I mention it is because I've got a couple of reviews in there, so go and download that if you get the chance.
Oh, you're not one of those people, are you, Tom?
What's that?
Just covering people's stuff when you're in it. You should be covering it and supporting it all the time.
Always, mate, always. I always, you know, say I've been reading Megavisions when I'm in it. No, right, news. Okay, so the first thing that we've got here is Slave. Mike,
yes.
Speak to me about Slave.
Who knows about Slave? No, so they've obviously got some more bugs now in the system for the game, which should have been released 2 years ago. And so they've asked for help, from what I'm saying, from other developers or people with knowledge to find the bugs and crush them.
Yeah, this before, is a game that we've discussed it many, many times. Are you familiar with Slave, Darren?
I've vaguely heard of it. It's the one with it's got all retro looking visuals. Looks a bit like Tron.
That's the one. Yeah, exactly. So this game has been it's been in kind of development hell for a while now, and every couple of months they send out an email to people who have either pre-ordered it or are supporters of the project. And the latest one is that they're now looking for people who have got Dreamcast development experience, skills, to like kind of come forward and help them with some bug squashing, as the term is. You know, when you've like been spending hours looking at something, I'm sure you get this, both of you, and then you get a fresh pair of eyes to come and have a look at it, see if you've done something wrong or there's any like shite there, to try and just kind of get rid of that. And that's what they're doing, basically. So I really wanted to just include this to say that if there's anybody who's listening to the podcast who is aware of this game, if you want to get involved and maybe lend a hand, you can go to the Goat Store website and, just drop them an email and give what support you can, really, in terms of development skills. It's a game I've been looking forward to for a while, and the video I've seen of it, it does look really cool. And to be honest, if we get an indie first-person shooter on the Dreamcast, I will be I'll be made up, frankly, because I'm a bit fed up with shmups and puzzle games. Not that that's
how dare you?
Can I say that? Yes, I agree.
I am listening to what you're saying.
Yeah. I was wondering. I could hear you snoring there for a second. Right, next piece of news is the RetroPie powered VMU, the VMU boy. I don't know if you saw this, Darren. I'm not sure if
I've not heard of this. I'm literally Googling it now because it sounds very exciting.
It's interesting. Basically, this guy, his name is Kite, or he goes by the name Kite on forums, and he has been working on this for a while, and he's basically shoehorned a Raspberry Pi and a screen and working controls into a VMU case. And now this thing
looks amazing.
Yeah, it's basically a fully blown RetroPie inside a VMU. I'm not sure how you know, how useful it would be with like those tiny controls. But
oh yeah,
as a proof of concept, it's very impressive. Yeah, I mean, I know that you are quite a fan of the Game Boy Advance, as I am, Darren. So, is this something that you would play on? Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The biggest problem with it is, like you said, it's a lack of buttons. But depending on what the quality of the emulation is like, depending on, you know, what you can get on it. Yeah, it looks pretty damn cool.
I like the way he's kind of shoehorned a little kind of D cell battery in the back of it as well, you know, which is better than an iPhone because at least you can change the battery when it runs out. So that's good.
Yeah, it's astonishing work, to be fair.
Yeah, I was really impressed. Yeah. What do you think, Mike? Have you got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, sewing myself up to the newsletter for when they release it.
Really?
Yeah. It looks cool. It looks amazing. It's not going to be, you know, my main go-to system any point in the future, but it's just, I think lots of people have been commenting about the fact of what's the point. Mm. The point is, it can be done. That's the point.
I always find that when anything kind of a little bit off the wall or a little bit kind of quirky comes along, you always get the naysayers who go, oh, what's the point of doing that when you can just have this, X, Y, and Z?
Exactly.
But
exactly.
For me, the point is because you can do it.
If through human history people had said, what's the point? Nothing would be done.
Very true. Yeah, very true indeed. So, yeah, that is the VMU boy. If you go to the Dreamcast Junkyard or indeed to Google and type in RetroPie VMU, you'll find it. Let us know what you think in the comments. That'd be interesting. However, that's all the news we're going to cover on this particular episode because, as you've already heard, we have a very special guest and we're going to interrogate him to within an inch of his life in the coming minutes. So, yeah, Darren, welcome once again to the Dream Pod. We're now going to talk to you exclusively about yourself and about your history of games, the Dreamcast and Retro Gamer magazine. And the first thing I really wanted to cover, obviously we have spoken about this on other podcasts that we've been on, namely Maximum Power Up. But for those people who haven't heard us chatting before, could you give us a little bit of background really as to who you are and the magazine and how you kind of got started in games journalism?
Oh, crikey.
Not to put you on the spot or anything, but, you know.
I've always enjoyed writing. I used to, I think that's probably from when I used to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm.
So I used to write adventures as a DM. Mainly because if you're the DM, you can make really bad shit happen to the players. So that's good fun. So I used to do a lot of writing, and it would take absolutely ages to do, and I just kind of fell in love with it from there. And then I kind of decided I wanted to get into the games industry. Mm. Trying to think when it was now. It's probably about 15 years or so ago, and I used to write for a website called, God damn it, I can't remember what they're called. Game Style.
Okay.
I believe they're still around. At the time, I think they were one of the first websites to be covering like the PS2.
Right.
And they were certainly probably one of the bigger, properly independent sites, because, you know, back then you had like IGN and Eurogamer and everything, but you know, they were a relatively small website in the grand scheme of things. And I started off on there as a, you know, just sort of writing reviews, and the whole thing was that, you know, you'd they'd send you a game to write about, and you'd get to keep the game in exchange for the review.
Mm.
And then I think I was there for a month or so, and I was getting a bit fed up with the games I was reviewing because I didn't necessarily get the good games. So I was just thinking, well, you know, if I was in charge of getting hold of the games, then I'd have first pick of the games.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that. And
so was that, sorry, Gary, was that kind of like, was that home based or was that like office based or what?
Oh, no, it was home based. I was, I think at the time I was working in car insurance at the time.
Really?
I'd done management in Tesco's previous to that. And then I moved into, worked for Liverpool Victoria. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was so long ago that when I used to work at Liverpool Victoria, there was this huge deal because they'd actually got an advert on, I think, Channel 5.
Right.
And, you know, this, whereas, you know, they're on TV all the time now. But mm-hmm. back then it was like a huge deal. And yeah, I just basically I felt like a change. I'd been doing a lot of writing for free at work where I was like writing for the company magazine, doing game reviews and DVD reviews or whatever else I could do just to like. Just for something to do.
Were you you weren't doing these kind of things on work time, were you?
While I should have been speaking to customers.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That makes two of us then. Carry on.
So basically, I applied for a job at Paragon at the time, and I wanted to work on XBM because I absolutely loved the Xbox. It was one of my favorite consoles.
Hmm.
And I basically got into a good conversation with the editor-in-chief there, Nick Roberts, and because they were impressed with the access that I had to PRs, and based on that, I managed to get onto Games TM completely by accident. Absolutely fluked it. And when I first started on there, I had an absolute nightmare because I was so used to writing in my own time that when you suddenly work on a magazine, everything is completely different because you only have X amount of time to review a game, you only have X amount of time to write about a game, and you have things like the magazine style and everything. Yeah. And I found it really, really tough going. And
I plugged away all that stuff.
Yeah, I just wasn't used to it, and I was just struggling, and you know my writing needed to develop and everything else, and it was touch and go for the first few months, and I just lucked out, and I soon managed to worm my way onto the retro section because I had a lot of interest in old games, and.
I love the term worm. You wormed your way into it.
Well, I did. I literally did. Because the vast majority of the retro section was focusing more on console stuff, and because I liked like the Amstrad and the Spectrum and all of that, I was able to, you know, add a little bit more to it, as it were.
Mm.
And so I did that. I took over the retro section from issue 19, I believe, and then I carried on. I'm doing that until I was headhunted to work in retro gaming, and I've been there ever since, and that's 12 years now.
Yeah, is it like 10 years now you've been the editor of Retro Gamer?
12 years.
12 years, wow, sorry.
Yep, 12 years.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple of really early issues of the magazine before it was based sort of down south where it is now, where it was based up in, is it Macclesfield or something?
I think it was like because it was Life Publishing, wasn't it? I think they were Manchester based.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, have you always been the editor, as it is like now based sort of?
Yeah. Since you obviously Martin Carroll was obviously the editor during the Life Publishing days. He still writes for the magazine. Actually, he's a great writer, and he does a lot of our really cool 8-bit Spectrum stuff. Yeah. So yeah, he was basically the editor for the first 18 issues, and then issue 19 they made, but it never went into production because of obviously all the problems. So we carried on with our own issue 19, and I've been the editor since then, and we're now on issue 176.
Wow, yeah. Quite the, I mean, the magazine is going from strength to strength. It's probably one of the most popular video game magazines there is, if I'm not mistaken. You know, I'm just going to say this now. It's a phenomenal job that you've done, and you know, I've got a lot of respect for what you do and what the other guys in the magazine do. I know there's a couple of other people that I speak to regularly on social media things, like Nick. Every time I open the magazine, I just see these amazing features. I'm just like, how have they come up with this? You know, where have they got the idea for this from? You know, and it's
I mean, to be fair, it's obviously a team effort. I mean, yeah. There's obviously you know, Nick writes a lot of our cover features, and we've got a great pool of freelancers, and we've been very lucky, particularly the last couple of years, and we've been getting really good access from a lot of prominent games publishers, because I think people are finally cottoning on to the fact that it's actually a magazine that isn't not going anywhere. And just because obviously it's called Retro Gamer, that doesn't mean that we don't cover new games in it.
Obviously. Yeah, obviously you reviewed Mario Odyssey, as we discussed earlier. Full disclosure as well, myself and Scott and Rob, Rob Jones, have all kind of done a little bit of freelance for the magazine in the past. So I just wanted to put that out there so it doesn't sound like I'm kind of blowing smoke or whatever. But Mike,
yes,
what are your thoughts on Retro Gamer? Obviously, Darren's here, so keep it civil.
I've always loved Retro Gamer. Retro Gamer is the reason I got back into Retro Gaming.
Really?
Picked up issue 20, I think it was. And ever since then, every single magazine, well, I did have all the magazines until last year, my big clear out, but every single magazine since. I love Retro Gamer. I was a regular on the forum for many years, and I think it's great to have Retro Gamer as a magazine on the stand, because there's so many articles in there which I think, as you've alluded to as well, but just they go into depth which you wouldn't be able to get otherwise. You know, it's great to have things online and online things, but you sort of pick and choose what you want to see online.
Yeah.
With a magazine on the stand, you sort of have things you wouldn't necessarily look into, which you're more likely to have access to. I always felt safe with Retro Gamer. The amount of consoles and games I've picked up due to Retro Gamer over the years is staggering, really. Not necessarily a good thing, because you'll see lots of money, but it's an institution. It's an institution now, Retro Gamer.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things I do like as well, Darren, is the way that you always kind of try and get input from people who are actually involved in a game that was being developed, or a publisher, for example. So rather than just having the thoughts and opinions of a particular journalist, you actually get it from, to use a phrase, the horse's mouth. Do you know what I mean?
I think you've got to do that, though. I mean, you know, one of the main reasons why Retro Gamer has been a success is because most of the content in it, if you don't read it in Retro Gamer, you don't read it. So,
exactly,
for example, you know, there's loads of websites saying, you know, Outrun's the best racing game ever and stuff like that. But there's nowhere which charts the actual making of the game apart from in Retro Gamer. And so I think that's the thing. And to be fair, it's not really that hard to do. There's obviously good writers who can basically write amazing articles, but ultimately, to me, I've always felt that you get more value if you're actually speaking to the people who are actually involved in those games, because the piece just carries a bit more weight to it.
Totally agree. Yeah, I mean, if you've got somebody who worked on XYZ game actually giving their kind of never before written or never before spoken about, you know, point of view on, you know, maybe something that isn't really that well known, it kind of adds a little bit more value to it, because it's like, oh, didn't know that. That's interesting. Do you know what I mean? And I'm one for like very niche, like minutiae when it comes to like games. And if I can get that from a source like Retro Gamer, then, you know, more power to it.
We obviously do lighter internet-y type stuff. So the Minority Reports, you know, they're typically the sort of things that you could read online. But I reckon around 70% of the content is like, it's all developer based. I mean, if you go through an issue and you look at how many actual people we've interviewed, it's quite a high number for the type of magazine it is.
I agree. What do you feel about the way that internet kind of culture is going more away from like written word towards like video content? Do you see that as a positive, because it means that more people come to the mag because it's actually a physical thing on a newsstand and they can kind of flick through it like without leaving the internet, for example?
It swings around about. So, I mean, I think there's a general thing where a lot of magazines and even a lot of websites tend to be afraid of YouTubers, for example, because of basically because they're called influencers, aren't they? I mean, I think that's a horribly shitty term, but that's a conversation for another time. But I think ultimately is that, you know, the way I look at things like YouTube is that ultimately you can get a much clearer idea of what a game's like and whether it's going to appeal to you. And you know, there are a lot of great retro channels, and you know, while you've got the standard ones where it's just somebody standing in front of a huge amount of games they'll probably never play, you'll get characters like Kim Justice who do like massively detailed retrospectives of companies and certain games or franchises. Mm-hmm. And so you can get good stuff on there. I think it's a mistake to simply dismiss the likes of YouTube and stuff. But I look at it as an appetizer, and it's like, well, you know, I can go on here and here's a game, and then 9 times out of 10, you might be able to get a bit more in-depth information about that game by either delving further online or finding a back issue of Retro Gamer or something.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of different YouTubers that I go to again and again. I mean, I quite like Larry Bundy's stuff.
Yeah, Larry does some great work. I mean, we're always trying to get him into the magazine, and it just hasn't worked out yet. But the plan is definitely there, because I'm a big fan of. He's got a great personality, and he's got a nice no nonsense approach to covering his stuff, which is quite refreshing.
Yeah, there's another guy called Nostalgia Nerd. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's quite good with his retro. Not so much about games, but more about like retro technology and retro kind of computers and that kind of thing. That's really fascinating. I love his stuff. But just to go back to like the written word versus video for a second, I think there's as much talent in crafting a well-written article as there is in crafting a well like produced video. So I think they're both valid sources, but there's, yeah, they've both got their own kind of target audience, you know.
There's always going to be, it's like when obviously the internet first became a thing, and it's like, oh, you know, magazines are dead. And it's like, there'll always be people who want to have magazines, and there'll always be people who just prefer to read articles over just watching something. So I think they're both means to an end, and ultimately, you know, it doesn't matter how you consume your love of retro. Just make sure that you're enjoying it with a nice beer or something.
Exactly, they can coexist. Oh. Coexist.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I think so.
Excellent. Well, Retro Gamer, we've spoken about the magazine. It's on all good newsstands as we speak. feel free to go buy a copy tomorrow after listening to this. Darren, let's talk about the Dreamcast. That's what we're here for. Now, as you alluded to earlier, you did have, or you were going for a full power collection at one point, but let's rewind from that point first. Let's talk about what are your first memories of the Dreamcast? Can you remember the first time you like were aware of the term Dreamcast, or when you first saw it or anything like that?
Yeah, well, I used to buy all the magazines at the time, so, you know, I was following it right from the beginning, because I've always been a big fan of Sega. I've got, you know, I've got, I think my first import console was a Japanese Mega Drive. Mm. And I've had every Sega console since then. So I was massively excited about the Dreamcast. I was massively excited about Shenmue until I got to actually play it. and basically, yeah, it was just this really exciting thing. And I think the first time I actually saw one up and running was, I can't remember the name of the shop, but there was a little game shop up in up near the Triangle in Bournemouth.
Oh yeah,
And it was actually run by the old retro editor of Games TM, who's sadly no longer with us. Oh. Keith, and I just happened to go in there one day because I was hoping to buy an N64 game for my collection. and I just saw them playing Sonic Adventure, and you know, it's obviously it's the cliche one which everyone remembers, but it's just when he's running down the in the beach level, and obviously the killer whale's chasing after him, and it was incredible. It just like it was literally astonishing.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's something that stays with everybody who sees it. My first kind of introduction with the Dreamcast was when a friend of mine bought one. It was a Japanese one with no modem on it. It was one of the really early ones. And he got Virtua Fighter 3 and I think it was Shotoku Battle, you know, Tokyo Highway Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
It was just absolutely mind-blowing because, like yourself, I had an N64 at the time and I was a big N64 gamer. And just seeing this completely, almost like it looked like silicon graphics or something for these games. And I was like, wow, you know. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, I missed the generation of consoles before the Dreamcast, so I sort of didn't play PS1, N64, or Saturn at all. And I was a PC gamer, and I saw Sonic Adventure and Soul Calibur, probably. Just absolutely mind-blowing, the graphics, and just...
Oh, yeah. Man, how good was Soul Calibur?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's when you first looked at it. Obviously, I was used to playing PC, which looked better, obviously, than consoles. But for the first time, for several years, the Dreamcast, it looked different. It had that sort of Sega look to it, and that sort of blue sky look, which you've spoken about many times on the podcast before.
Yeah.
That sort of just looked amazing. It still does to me now. That's what I still love it for.
Yeah. Because Soul Calibur actually looked... I mean, this just might be my mind, my aged mind playing tricks on me, but Soul Calibur actually looked better than the arcade original.
Yeah. I'll
be honest with you. I never actually played Soul Calibur before... seen it on the Dreamcast, but I've since watched, you know, loads of footage. I've seen the Digital Foundry videos of Soul Calibur versus the original Namco arcade version, and yeah, the arcade version looks almost like a PlayStation game. So yeah, the leap above is something else, really.
Soul Calibur was just, we don't talk about Soul Calibur enough on this podcast.
We don't, do we? No.
It was an exceptional game. The amount of content they put into it. Yeah, for a fighting game is standing.
Yeah, with that map where you could kind of like walk around and then go to different things and do different challenges. Some of the challenges where you were like sinking into the ground unless you did so many kicks or something. Do you know what? Yeah. I'm going to play Soul Calibur in a bit when we finish.
Yeah, yeah.
it's still held up really well. In fact, I prefer the challenge stuff in the first Soul Calibur to Soul Calibur 2.
Mm.
Yeah, it's... We had an interesting question on the podcast last time about if Soul Calibur 2 had come to the Dreamcast, what would the secret character have been?
Yes.
Any ideas, Darren?
What secret character would you have had on? You'd have had Ryo, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Did you say that last time, Mike?
Yes. Okay. Just like chucking forklift trucks at people.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
I said Big the Cat, and I stand by
that.
Oh, you
did? Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he'd be quite good, because he's actually got a weapon, hasn't he, in the form of a fishing rod.
Yeah.
And they could have made full fishing rod compatibility.
Yeah, because you could play with it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And then what did Namco do after that? They pretty much stopped making games for it, didn't they? They did Mr. Driller, and I can't really think of much other stuff.
Was it Namco Museum? As well,
and that
was pretty much it, to be honest,
because that was a great use of the Dreamcast power, wasn't it?
Yeah. So Darren, after you first got the console, you went into, was it straight into like collecting to get like a full set, or was it
years? Oh god, past, no I did that much later. I kind of got the Dreamcast when it first came out, and then I didn't really start collecting, going for the complete PAL collection until I was on Retro Gamer. So it's probably about seven, eight years ago, because I used to cover it all on my YouTube channel, and I fell into that classic trap of where you put videos up of your latest purchases, everybody would obviously like him and stuff, And then you'd be like, oh, this video is really popular. I know, I'll do another one of these. And then you just obviously buy more stuff. And yeah, I think, because what is it? It's about 219 Dreamcast games.
Over to Mike.
216, if you don't include Sega Swirl.
And so I think I was about 35 games short, and then I stopped.
Was that just because you were bored of it, or?
Well, no, I just realised it was fucking pointless. Basically, what I mean by that, to clarify, is that my whole approach to collecting for the Dreamcast was completely the wrong way to go. So what I mean by that was I was buying all the good stuff. You know, so I'd get like Street Fighter Third Strike, and I basically bought all the really, really good stuff. And then I think the last 35 odd games, they were utter shit.
Well, like Spirit of Steam 1937, for example.
And I remember looking through it, and I was looking at how much it was going to cost me, and it was like, you know, these are all under 5 out of 10 games. Yeah. And it's going to cost me around 500 quid. And who the fuck am I going to impress by saying, hey, I've got a complete PAL Dreamcast collection. And I just stopped like that. I just thought, this is fucking insane. Why do I want all of these games, which I know are fucking rubbish, just so I can say I've got a complete collection of something? And I just stopped. And with that, I pretty much downsized my entire collection, which is now down to about 10 PAL games, and I've got about 25 Japanese games, which are largely shoot 'em ups because it's my favourite genre.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who I know who are in our Facebook group, for example, who listen to this podcast, who are, you know, PAL collectors, who have got PAL collections or full sets. And
apologies, guys. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I appreciate the dedication, and I know what it gets like, because you get so excited about tracking down those games, particularly, you know, particularly if it's like a rarer game like Taxi. But ultimately, to me, it becomes a space issue as well, because, you know, they take up and it was getting to a stage where I was like double stacking stuff. So I'd have like games behind games, and it's like, well, I can't even fucking see them. What's the point?
No, I wasn't saying that because, you know, to try and sort of guilt trip you, but I mean, I don't own a PAL sort of complete set myself. You know, any games I can't get or don't want to pay for that are, you know, PAL that I don't own, I just get them American or Japanese for a lot cheaper. But back when I started the Dreamcast Junkyard in like sort of 2005, 2006, nobody gave a shit about the Dreamcast. Nobody was collecting them. Nobody gave a fuck about getting a full PAL set. So I would go off and, you know, go to, because I was living in Manchester at the time, I'd go to like, I'd just find a somewhere on the map and go, right, I'll go to Oldham, or I'll go to Liverpool, or I'll go to Sheffield, and I'll just go there and see if I can find a game shop, and, you know, they might have some Dreamcast games, and if they do, then I'll buy them, and I'll write a blog about them. That's really how the Dreamcast Junkyard started. And
that's cool.
That was kind of like my little kind of hobby for a bit. And so it was almost like nobody else was doing this. So it was almost like a little kind of individual thing, whereas I don't want to alienate anyone or like slag anyone off, but it's almost become like a sort of a badge of honour to have gotten a full PAL set, and it's all to do with how much money you've got, as opposed to going to a certain place and finding stuff and like stumbling across stuff randomly. Do you know what I mean?
I'd obviously like to clarify as well that I'm not saying collecting a complete Dreamcast collection is pointless. I just think collecting all systems for a complete collection is pointless, because ultimately you end up with a load of games which you are never going to play. And surely the point of games is that they're to be played with. Mm-hmm. I mean, that piece you wrote, you know, is obviously a while back now, about the whole collecting side. And it is, it's a slippery slope you go down, because, you know, you're sharing your pickups with social media, and, you know, you're collecting likes, and then you kind of lose track of of what you're doing, and it's like, you know, am I buying these games because I want to play them, or am I buying these games because I just want to? And it kind of becomes a willy waving competition. It's like, you know, look how big my willy is. I've got every single Dreamcast game ever made, and all of these white label discs, and you know, it's obviously great for some people, and if you want to do that, brilliant. But it's not for me.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. As you say, that article I wrote about getting rid of all my gaming stuff. Since I've got rid of it all, I feel like I've got an increased vigor now for like mainly just focusing on the Dreamcast. Do you know what I mean, rather than just like being scattergun and getting anything I can?
It feels like a weight lifts off you. I mean, I did a similar thing a while back when I wanted to raise money for a camera lens, and I was trying to work out how to do it. And the easiest thing to do was to sell games, and making that initial jump and thinking, like, oh, what if I miss it? You know, what am I going to do? But ultimately, if you love something that much, you'll just buy it again. and it was really difficult to make that first step, but once I started selling those games, and once I could see the price rising and knowing that I'd be able to pick up this lens I wanted, it just didn't become an issue. And you know, ultimately, all the games I've got rid of, I've not missed. I think there's been one, and I've picked it back up again, and that's it. Because the way I was looking at it was, you know, if it's a lot easier to buy, like, say, to spend £50 on a game again that you want, rather than £1,000 on a camera lens.
Yeah. I know you're quite into your cameras and things. I do need to ask you about that, so we'll save that for after the podcast. Anyway, so obviously we've spoken about kind of Dreamcast, the launch, and you know, various like aspects of collecting. What's your kind of opinion on like the scene today? I mean, myself and Mike are quite sort of involved in the scene, so we see it from the inside, as it were. Obviously, you are the editor of the most popular retro game magazine on the planet, but I'm imagining that you have a kind of a wide view of the whole of retro gaming, whereas myself and Mike are kind of in the trenches, as it were, in the Dreamcast scene. So how does it appear to you, not necessarily from the outside, if you know what I'm saying, but from a slightly, you know, a step back, as it were?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one. I mean, retro gaming in general, regardless of whether it's just a Dreamcast or anything else, is, you know, it's grown exponentially the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people, obviously, either wanting to make money or very successfully making money off it. I think all of that in turn has started to really drive the prices up. I mean, look at Dreamcast games. I sold most of my Dreamcast collection for, you know, a price I was happy with. But if I'd waited, I could have got like seven to ten times that.
Wow!
Because the prices are just shooting up. So I think my understanding of Dreamcast followers is that they're very fanatical. They you know, they have a massive love for the system. I think it's funny actually, because we've been doing we're doing a big feature for our January issue, which is basically covering the greatest games machines of all time.
Mm.
So it covers everything from early video game systems to obviously modern day systems. So we asked loads of readers via Twitter, social media, the forums. You know, basically, name your top 10 favorite systems.
Oh yeah, I think I filled that out.
I'm not going to say where it placed, but all I'll say is that I've always known the Dreamcast was popular. I didn't realize how fucking popular it was until our poll results come in.
Well.
That's because I voted 12 times, though.
No, I blame a lot of that on Shenmue fans.
Yes. I blame a lot on Shenmue fans.
But no, I mean, you know, regardless of whether it's the Dreamcast, regardless of whether it's the Super Nintendo, the Saturn, it's great when you get websites like Dreamcast Junkyard where because they basically become rallying points, because ultimately our human nature is that we're very tribal, and yeah. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're following a football club, whether you're following a console, and it's interesting to see how people are drawn to stuff and then how they absolutely support it.
Yeah.
Like it's the greatest thing ever.
It's a good point, actually. I mean, even today, even now, in 2017, you see people might post something in our Facebook group regarding the PlayStation 2, and it'll get so many down, like, you know, angry faces, or kick this guy out of the group, or, you know, and it's just like, guys, chill. It's just, you know, it's just a comment.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things that I don't like about retro gaming. And
yeah,
I think that's and again, it applies to all systems. And one of the things that's really, really interesting about a lot of, you know, not everyone, but when you start becoming entrenched with a certain system, you have ridiculous opposing views towards anything else which isn't that system. And so you've obviously, you know, at the end of the day, this isn't going to make me popular, but the PS2 is a better console than the Dreamcast.
Mm-hmm.
It had better support. It had a huge amount of better games, and you know, and basically, it's the best selling machine of all time. And it wouldn't be the best selling machine of all time unless there was a reason for it. And but I think one of the things with the Dreamcast is because it was Sega's last console, and because it was obviously the underdog. You know, people love an underdog. But I think because it was Sega's last machine, that's helped keep it in everybody's hearts, because, you know, it's that last bit of when it's the last bastion of when Sega were this truly great publisher, and it wasn't. Because obviously Sega's a lot different now to what it was during that period.
Mm.
And again, you look at the Dreamcast, and it was a really brave machine, because, you know, everybody was moving across to huge experiences like, you know, continuing Resident Evil and everything else. And
yeah.
Sega were like, you know what? We're going to make fucking arcade games, and that's going to be the predominant thing we do, and they're going to be amazing. And they were amazing. But next to the likes of Resident Evil and everything else, it wasn't enough. And yes, you had Code Veronica, and yes, you had Shenmue, and yes, you had Skies of Arcadia. But I'd argue that it was too little, too late. And there's some amazing games on the Dreamcast. Jet Set Radio is sensational. I love all the House of the Dead, but I just don't think it was the machine that the general public wanted to play on at the time.
That's a very valid point.
I think that hurt it as well. And then obviously when you take into account all the difficulties Sega had with the hardware, and the fact that obviously it wasn't doing well at the time anyway, it just all compounded. And it was kind of like the unperfect storm, if you will.
Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting is the way that there's quite a lot of new adopters to the machine who maybe weren't even around when the Dreamcast was a contemporary system. My personal love for the console comes mainly from the fact that it was probably the first console that I kind of bought as an adult and could make a decision to just go and buy one for myself. And also, I was, you know, in that period of my life, I was like sort of like late teens. And I was kind of going from being a kid to an adult, and it kind of came with me. Do you know what I mean? And ever since then, it's just stayed with me. And I can't really put a definite reason why on it. But what interests me is the way that the console has almost got like a mythical status now, that guys or girls who, you know, weren't around when the console was actually a contemporary machine have kind of been dragged up in the sort of the tailwind, if you will, of this, like, you know, legendary console. And that's, yeah, and it, that's a good thing, in my opinion. You know, it's continuing, yeah, the legacy of the system. But
I mean, interesting. I'd argue one of the things that obviously caused the issues back in the day, i.e. the sheer amount of arcade stuff, is one of the main reasons why it's so popular now, because those games are accessible as hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can instantly play something like Power Stone. You can instantly play Crazy Taxi. Because there are so many of these great pick-up and play games. And, you know, they probably seemed expensive at the time. I mean, look at Street Fighter Third Strike.
Yeah.
You know, it was largely getting sixes and sevens from everybody at the time, because why the hell are Capcom making a 2D fighting game? It's now widely considered to be one of the best examples of its genre ever, and people are still playing it. And if you want to play a great version of it, what better than to play it on the Dreamcast?
It's weird when you think about it, how, like, kind of attitudes and you know, appreciations change over time. Because let's be honest, I mean, if a console like the Dreamcast came out now with the resurgence in 2D games and like pixel art adventures and that kind of thing, the Dreamcast would kill it. You know, that's my opinion anyway. I mean, obviously it's a very capable 3D machine, but the 2D games are, you know, fantastic. You know, the 2D fighters, the 2D RPGs, a lot of which are now obviously indie games, but they're still kind of holding their own against stuff like Golf Story on the Switch. Yeah, it's a really good system that kind of almost transcends different generations, because you have such a vast style of game on the...
Nick made a really good point the other day, because again, we were talking about it, and I kept on saying to him, you know, why is it doing so well in the polls? And one of the points that he made as well is that because it's easy to forget that the Dreamcast is very much like the GBA, in that it had, despite the fact that it's got a really interesting, diverse library, it wasn't really on sale for a long time.
Mm.
And Nick was saying that, you know, the last 2 years of its life, there was so much stuff came out, and it was such an amazing time to have the console. And so it burned briefly, but it burned really brightly, and that's what a lot of people remember.
Yeah.
Just because you had all these games like Shenmue and everything else, and, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Shenmue, but I can appreciate why people love it. And you just had Metropolis Street Racer and everything else, and there just seemed to be nothing like it at the time. You just had it just seemed to be hit after hit after hit after hit.
Just a couple more questions now, really, actually, for you, Darren. The first one is, if like the Dreamcast had continued even for like another year, do you think that it would have continued to kind of wane, or do you think maybe there would have been maybe a resurgence with like all the games that were planned and then shoved onto the consoles if they'd come out on the Dreamcast? Do you think that would have helped at all, or was it too late?
I think PS2 was too entrenched. I mean, one of the things that I can remember, I read Dreamcast magazine, and you, towards the end of the system's life, I had a machine, I had a Dreamcast then, and every month you were just reading news stories about this game's been cancelled, this game's been cancelled, this has been, and it was just so disheartening as an actual owner of the machine, because, I think this is where a lot of the rivalry stem from, because again, depending on your age, you know, if the Dreamcast was like your first console, and you were like a kid or a teenager, odds are, and again, this goes back to the whole tribal thing, odds are you could only afford to have the one games machine. And so, you know, obviously if you had a Dreamcast, as far as you were concerned, that shitty PS2 was getting all your games. And, yeah, you know, fuck the PS2. That's not fair. It's, you know, it's getting all the stuff that I should be getting. And you know, gamers in general are very entitled. And it just stems from that. And that's where these rivalries come from. And, you know, as a Dreamcast owner, it just looked, Christ, you know, Legacy of Kain, that looked amazing. Oh, it's been cancelled, but look, the PS2's getting it.
I remember.
So
that,
I think think that's what I think. Why? Because you see a lot of interestingly, you see a lot of hatred from Dreamcast owners towards PS2 owners, but you don't see it the other way around.
Mm.
And I think a lot of it is because they just don't care, because why would you care? They're just games machines. And I think if you're the sort of person who basically says, like, you know, the Switch is the best system ever, and I'm not going to ever touch the Vita because it's the disgusting Sony machine, you're doing yourself a disservice because you're missing out on good games.
Hmm.
And that goes for anything, whether you're fanatically loyal about the Spectrum or the Dreamcast or the GameCube or whatever. You know, games are games, and I just love playing games, and I don't, you know, I'm lucky, you're lucky when your system has a lot of the games you like playing, but ultimately if you go down the route of supporting only one system or one company, you end up missing out on a hell of a lot of good games.
Couldn't agree more, to be honest. Yeah, very wise words. Lastly, Darren, one last thing I want to ask you. The Dreamcast obviously brought a lot of things with it when it came. What do you think are, like, the overarching or the lasting influences that the Dreamcast kind of left on the gaming industry, if any?
I think it's obviously the fan base it's created. I'd argue that the Dreamcast was very, very influential in making people pay attention to the shoot 'em up genre, because while it was obviously always popular during the 16-bit era and stuff, it kind of fell out of fashion, and then it kind of became a running joke that, hey, look, there's another Dreamcast game coming out, and hey, look, it's a shooter. But that's literally what was happening, and people were paying attention. And if it highlighted one thing, it proved that there was interest enough in that genre for people to start releasing shoot 'em ups on other systems. And if you look at like the Xbox 360, there's a lot of parallels with the Xbox 360 in Japan, where it was pretty much kept alive by shoot 'em ups in the same way that the Dreamcast was.
Interesting. And also, obviously, there's the whole online gaming thing as well, with like Xbox Live, yeah, which kind of had its roots maybe even in, like, you know, Dream Arena or SegaNet. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, you could obviously argue that that Xbox done it miles better, but ultimately, you know, again, if you had a Dreamcast in the day, and if you were one of those guys who would fall asleep at his keyboard playing Phantasy Star Online, you know, that's where it all started. So, and even you could even get downloadable stuff, couldn't you, on the Dreamcast? So
yeah.
You could, like, download your music onto the VMUs and that. So yeah, no, I think it's and ironically as well, going back to what I was saying earlier, just the very fact that it was Sega's last console means that people will always love it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Wise words. Thank you for your input there, Darren. It's obviously much appreciated. And a lot to think about there. What we're going to finish with now, though, Darren, for your delectation, is a quiz.
Oh, dear. Do you like it? I've been dreading this.
No, it's a very nice quiz. It's called the, I've given it a proper name as well. It's called Tom's Super Duper Darren's Dreamcast Quizathon, sponsored by Mike.
Nice.
So, kind of rolls off the tongue, don't you think?
Yeah.
So what we've got here for you, Darren, is we've got 12 titles that could or could not be Dreamcast games, Japanese, American, or PAL. And you have to tell me whether or not they are or they aren't.
Christ.
So what we'll do is I'll run through the 12 of them, and I'll just take some notes like a teacher. And at the end, I'll tell you whether or not you've got them right or incorrect. Okay, are you ready?
Hold on.
Let me know when you're ready and I'll begin.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Question number one. Tell me, Darren, if this is a real Dreamcast game. Bomber Hee Hee.
That's real. That was Demolishing Buildings, wasn't it?
It was indeed. Well done.
It was.
Okay. Next, Matrix Blaster.
You know something? That sounds real, but you know something? I'm going to say it's real. It sounds like a shooting game.
Okay. Question number three. Pile of Bullets.
Oh, that's got to be real. That's going to be a homebrew game. I'm sure that's real.
Okay. Next, we've got Sweet Season.
No idea. I'm going to say, I can imagine it's got like hentai girls in it, and it's a really dodgy Japanese shoot 'em up with underage girls in it, but I've got absolutely, I'm going to say no.
You're going to say it's fake?
Yeah, I'm going to say it's fake.
Okay.
It sounds like the sort of game I'd probably play if you've seen what my PS Vita collection's like.
I've seen it, yes. Okay, moving on. This is question number 5 of 12. Shanghai Dynasty.
That sounds like it's real. That sounds like a Japanese ambition-y type of game. So I'll say that's real.
Okie doke. I've recorded your answer. I'll move on to the next one, which is Finish Line.
Finish Line. Finish Line sounds like a really shit racing game from the 90s. Yeah, do you know something? I'll say that's real. And if it isn't, it should be.
Okay, moving on to number 7, Bone Storm.
You know something? Bone Storm. I'm sure Bone Storm is the name of a game from The Simpsons, so I'm going to say it's fake.
Okay. Next on the list is Never 7, The End of Infinity.
God, that sounds like a bloody Japanese RPG. You know something? I'm going to say that's fake as well.
Okay. We've got 4 left. You'll be relieved to hear. The next one is Sister Princess Premium Edition.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like a Dreamcast game. Yeah, I'm going to say that's real. That sounds like a dating game because they released loads, didn't they, in Japan?
They did. Mike's a big fan of the dating game.
Yeah, I won't say fan.
He enjoys them. The next one is Air to Ground Actions.
I'm going to say that's fake.
Okay, number 11 is Imperial No Taka, Fighter of Zero.
That sounds real. I'll say that's real.
And last but not least, Space Paranoids.
I'm going to say that's real as well.
Okay, let's see and how you did.
How bad am I when it comes to Japanese Dreamcast games?
Darren Jones, editor of Retro Gamer, the biggest retro gaming magazine on the planet. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 12. Not bad.
Oh, that's fucking terrible.
I was trying to be nice. let's review.
That is atrocious.
Let's review your answers. Okay, Bomber Hee, you said correct. That is correct. That's a Dreamcast game. Matrix Blaster, you said that was a real game. That's a fake game. That's from Tron, the film Tron. Right. Number 3. Pile of Bullets.
See, I knew it sounded familiar.
Pile of Bullets, you said that sounded real. That's actually a fake game from the TV show Community.
Oh, of course it is.
Number 4, that's Sweet shit. Season, you said that was fake. It's actually a real game.
Is it a dodgy hentai game?
Mike, can you elaborate on that one?
What, Sweet Season?
Yeah.
It's a visual novel, I think.
Yeah.
But That's why I've never heard of it, because why would I buy or show any interest in a Japanese game which I can't read?
Number five, you said that Shanghai Dynasty was a real game. That is correct. Mike, yes. Have you got any more details on that one?
Yeah, Shanghai, it's the sort of table version of Mahjong, which we is in games. One of the many, many Shanghai games.
One of the many, many Shanghai games. Number six was, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Finish Line, that you said was real. That's actually fake. That is from Wreck-It Ralph.
It is, yeah. Of course it is.
Bone Storm, you got that correct. That's a fake game.
Simpsons, isn't it?
It's from The Simpsons, yeah. So actually, you've actually got 6 out of 12. I marked that wrong. Sorry, you got 6. Number 8, Never 7, The End of Infinity. That is a real game.
Yep.
Mike, if you please.
Yeah, it's part of the Infinity series. There's Never 7, Never 17, Never 7, or Ever 17 and Never 7. I can't remember which one's which.
Yeah, that's correct. Sister Princess Premium Edition, that was correct. Real game, that was correct. Again,
yeah,
Mike,
of course it was. it was a premium edition.
Yeah.
Probably comes with a pair of knickers or something. That PS Vita game I've got.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Galgun,
yeah. Yeah, I think we spoke about that recently on one of the podcasts. Number 10, that was Earthground Actions. You said that was fake, and it was indeed fake. That is from the film War Games. And number 11, Imperial No Taka, Fighter F-Zero. You said that was real. It is real. That's the Japanese name for Iron Aces, which is a flight sim based on World War II. And last but not least, Space Paranoids, you said that was true or real, and that's fake. That's also from Tron. So, 6 out of 10, Darren. Not bad. 50%. Should feel proud.
Well, that's not too bad, is it?
No, not too bad. Not too bad. It's terrible. No. But thank you for taking part in that quiz, and thank you for taking part in the podcast as a whole, to be honest. We've been chatting now for an hour and 20 minutes, so I think what we're going to do is we're going to draw a line under this particular episode. However, from myself and from Mike, Darren Jones, thank you very much for finally being a part of the Dream Pod. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Yep. No worries, it's been good fun.
It has indeed, yeah. Anyone who would like to... Sorry, go ahead.
If you don't hear from me, it's probably because I've been killed by your listeners.
Yeah. We won't give out your details or your address details in the show notes as we do with our usual guests. So, but yeah, thanks very much for being on, and thanks very much for being a good sport with the quiz. If people want to find you on social media, where can they find you, Darren?
Do you know something? I think let me have a look at my actual Twitter, because I'll be buggered if I know what it is. Let's have a look. It appears to be retrogamer_Daz.
There you go.
Yeah, at retrogamer_Daz, or you can obviously, if you just want to follow the magazine, it's retrogamer_mag.
Fantastic. I'm already a follower. Mike, where can people find you on Twitter?
So I am, as usual, space_turnip.
Fantastic. And you can follow me at Tom Lee C. You can also follow us as a collective at the DC Junkyard. You can find us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/TheDreamcastJunkyard. And also our amazing group, which has actually gone past 10,000 followers this week. It's facebook.com/groups/TheDreamcastJunkyard. And obviously our main site, which is www.thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. Thank you both for joining me on this cold November evening for a lovely chat about the Dreamcast. And until the next time, we'll see you on the flip side. Everybody, say goodbye. Bye. Bye.
Please stop this disc now.